Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Every year, hundreds of thousands of students from all over the world come to the United States to study at American colleges and universities. When they graduate with highly specialized and coveted degrees, many of them want to live and work here. They want to stay here. But only about 23% of foreign students who obtain master's degrees in the U.S. end up staying. And for those who get bachelor's degrees, that number is just 11%. And remember, those numbers are far lower than the number of people who want to stay in the United States. So why is the U.S. training and educating so many people in jobs we so desperately need, and then just letting them leave? In the meantime, countries like Canada, the U.K., and Australia are poaching these U.S. trained and educated folks to work in places like London, Toronto, and Sydney. Well, John Marcus is a higher education editor and reporter at the Hechinger Report, and he's reported about this particular brain drain in an article headlined, "With New Talent Visas, Other Countries Lure Workers Trained at U.S. Universities." And we've got a link to it at onpointradio.org. And John joins us here in the studio today. Welcome to On Point, John.
Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, so give me some more specific numbers about how many foreign students we're talking about at the undergraduate and graduate level.
Well, about 1 million foreign students come to the United States every year, and we educate them at every level, including at the graduate level, and it's very hard for them to stay. They can stay after they graduate through something called an OPT, or Optional Practical Training Visa, that lets them stay for from 12 to 36 months, depending on their major. Then they have to get an H-1B, which is very, very hard, and an employer sponsor. The result of which is that not all of them, but many of them have skills in areas like computer science and electrical engineering, which are in very high demand in the United States and for which we produce very few domestic graduates, American graduates. And so we need these students, but we make it really hard for them to stay.
Yeah. So about those graduate level computer science and electrical engineering degrees, in your article, you have a fact that just made my eyes pop out. What percentage of folks are foreign-born in those graduate programs?
It is amazing. My eyes popped out, too. 80% of graduate students in computer science and electrical engineering are foreign-born. Only 1 in 5 students at the graduate level in those fields, in the most important kinds of subjects in a knowledge economy, only 1 in 5 of them are American. And as you've seen in the last few weeks, math scores in the K-12 level in America are getting even worse. And so we're just not producing people that know math. Math is a prerequisite for programs like that. And in some particularly high demand fields like AI, you've got half of the workforce in AI, one of the fastest emerging fields. Half of the workforce is foreign born, and half of the graduate students in fields that lead to AI are foreign born.
So we're going to come back to some of the whys in just a second, but I just want to mention that oftentimes people will say, well, part of the reason why there's so many foreign-born graduate students is because of the money factor for the universities. We'll come back to that. And then also there's always a question about wages in terms of who is taking jobs in these very, very hard-to-fill fields. So those are. I just want to say that we're going to come back to those in a second. But so tell me a little bit more about these four words, the U.S. immigration system. Like, what's going on there that's making it so difficult for folks that we keep saying we need to fill jobs to stay?
Well, it isn't news that the U.S. immigration system is fairly dysfunctional. We're speaking here about a very small corner of it, which is immigrants with skills in areas of high demand. And the process for them to be able to stay is very, very difficult. That another really important point to make is that people still want to come to the United States.
Right.
They want to come to the United States because in tech fields in particular, because the United States offers significant amounts of venture capital, lots of opportunity. And we make it really, really hard for those people to come and stay. We have heard, and your listeners will have heard about a lot of layoffs. at big tech companies, but there remain huge numbers of openings for people in those fields in smaller companies, in the IT department of a non-tech company. So these are still areas where we need talent and we're sending it away.
Well, I want to go through an example from a particular person about exactly what you're talking about, both the challenges in staying in the United States after receiving a U.S. degree, and then the options that these folks have, which is what you've reported on, John. So in 2018, Sudeep Dutta moved from India to the United States to get a master's degree at the University of South Florida in Tampa. He's a data analyst, and his wife, Suchi Bakshi, was already studying in Tampa.
Our plan was like to study and gain knowledge because US, as you know, the university and the research department are very like very detailed, very, they have a lot of funds, they have a lot of different projects. And after we gain the knowledge, get the degree, and then utilize my knowledge in the work field because there are so much opportunity in US on particularly in these niche skills.
Well, as Sudeep says, they wanted to stay in the United States and work. When his wife Suchi graduated, she applied for an H-1B visa, which allows a person to work in the U.S. for up to 6 years. But two things must happen first, as John Marcus mentioned. An employer must agree to sponsor the applicant, and she has to go through the H-1B visa lottery system, which had, at one time, a 1-in-4 chance of picking Suchi's name. Okay, so Suchi had 3 tries at the lottery. On her second try, she got picked in 2019. Meanwhile, her husband Sudeep was still studying. He graduated that fall and applied for the OPT, or Optional Practical Training Visa, that temporary work visa that allows him to work while he entered the H-1B lottery. Having a master's degree gave Sudeep an advantage, but it's still a lottery.
I was like very optimistic, like, okay, my wife, she got it. I will also get it. Don't worry. But immigration and things are very like tense and very like you are not sure what will happen. You will get or you will not get the, in the lottery system. So there is no like 100% surety, right? And another issue was since we were having like 8-10 years of experience, and me and my wife, we were thinking of planning to start a family. Also, we were not able to do that because we don't have that surety. So it was always a stress and it was always like uncertainty.
In April 2020, Sudeep found out he didn't get picked. So he applied in the lottery again. His U.S. employer wanted him to stay with the company, but didn't see many options if Sudeep did not get that H-1B. His employer didn't see working from India as a viable option, and neither did Sudeep because he and his wife haven't lived in India since 2013. They really liked the United States and wanted to stay. Well, on April 10th, 2021, the lottery for Sudeep's second attempt at an H-1B visa was drawn.
And I remember in my office in my company, the lawyer, they logged in and they checked and they said, no, your name is not there. And we have like a rental apartment, so we don't know if it we get to renew or not. So these are all uncertain things and was not a good day.
His wife still had her H-1B visa, so Sudeep could stay in the U.S. with her, but he could not work.
Other option is, again, I have to go back to study, maybe do a PhD. I talked with my professors and everyone, but I then rated myself. I am not a PhD guy. I am not a research guy, a deep research. I am a commercial guy. I work on business problems and IT problems like that. So I wanted to utilize that part of my experience. So I was not wanted to go back to PhD.
Okay, further graduate study was out. And then,
sadly, that time my wife, she lost her job. And her company, they were not doing well. And they laid off a lot of people from their head office. And on H-1, you get like 60 days of time to get a new job.
That 60-day deadline to keep the H-1B includes getting all the paperwork done and processed. So Suchi applied to dozens of jobs as fast as she could and luckily found one in time. So she could stay, at least for now.
So we were through those harsh times. And that time in the month of April, we thought of, okay, we have to take things on our hand. We have to be controlling. We have to decide our company, USCIS, or all these factors which are not our hand, the lottery. So we have to take control and we have to utilize our educations.
In other words, the uncertainty of the U.S. immigration system had become intolerable. So the Yipen Suchi began looking for options in other countries. They found that Canada has an express visa specifically for people like them, highly educated and who work in tech. And interestingly, Canada still requires that a Canadian company sponsor the visa, but that was no problem. So the Yipen Suchi easily found a Canadian sponsor. But even more interestingly, the Canadian sponsor didn't even hire the couple. They just sponsored their visa. So Sudeep and Suchi moved to Canada while still working remotely for their U.S. employers. In April of 2022, they moved to Toronto.
So when we moved, my wife, she was already pregnant. She delivered here. And now we are like we are certain and we are in a positive mind on weekends that there is no immigration thing that we have to worry about or any paperwork which is ending that we have to renew and do all the paper gathering and submit.
And then in December of 2022, just 8 months after they moved to Toronto, the Canadian government granted Sudeep and Suchi permanent resident status.
And with that, I can switch companies, I can work with these companies and not to rely on employer to file my work authorization, then only they will hire me. So that power gave me back is like a freedom, I would say.
Meaning Sudeep Datta, his wife Suchi Bakshi, and their son plan on staying in Canada for the foreseeable future. And John Marcus, you're just nodding your head in disappointment there.
I mean, look at that case and listen to the hoops they had to jump through trying to stay in the United States. So what happens ultimately is that we've educated this couple to go and apply their skills in another country that competes against us.
And what's even more interesting, and this is why your story was so compelling, when we come back, we'll talk about it, is that other countries are actively recruiting these folks.
Aggressively recruiting.
Okay. So John Marcus is with us today. He's higher education editor for the Hechinger Report, and he's written a fabulous, fascinating article about why it's not only so hard for highly educated foreign-born students in the United States to stay, but how other countries are benefiting from our broken immigration system. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and John Marcus is with us today. He's higher education editor for the Hechinger Report. And John, first of all, I just want to get a little update from you on the likelihood of getting an H-1B visa in this country right now. When we heard Sudeep's story, at that time, with the lottery, it was a 1 in 4 chance. But it's even harder now?
We haven't raised the maximum number of people who can get an H-1B visa in 30 years. And the result of that is, and this is to the credit of you know, our economy and the number of people that want to come and work here. So many people applied for an H-1B visa this year that the number who were accepted fell to 1 in 7.
Okay. So it's even harder now. But that's because demand is still really high.
People do want to come to the United States.
But you also just said we haven't actually raised the number, the cap, in 30 years?
It's set by Congress and it hasn't been raised since the 1980s.
So it's not a percentage. It's an actual number.
It's an actual number.
In 30 years, even though, as we've been talking about, in some of these sectors, the demand for talent is through the roof and they cannot fill jobs.
In the United States, but as we're going to discuss in a moment, in other countries, they've recognized this and have adjusted their immigration systems accordingly.
Okay. 30 years. Most of the companies that are looking for people right now in the United States didn't even exist back then.
We haven't changed anything about our immigration system, really, not in 30 years. Nothing major.
Okay. We'll come back to that. So you've written about these new talent visas in different countries. other countries are seeing an opportunity here. What are their talent visas?
So this is what got us interested in this topic, is that we've seen other countries, some of them all equally hostile to immigration, such as the UK, that have introduced talent, global talent visas, to attract precisely the people that they need in tech. And the other big occupation is in healthcare. So not only have they introduced these kinds of global talent visas for immigrants in general, but they are going very specifically after graduates of our best universities and colleges. In the UK, so the countries that are doing this most actively are Australia, Canada, and the UK. Other countries are doing it too, Portugal, France, and Singapore, but they are a little bit less attractive to immigrants in these fields than those other than we are and these other three countries. In the UK, they introduced a visa with a terrible name. It's called the High Potential Individual Visa, which sort of makes you wonder what the rest of us are. But the visa allows you to immigrate to the UK if you have graduated from 40 of what are considered the best universities in the world. Not surprisingly, 21 of those are in the United States. And so they've made it very easy for graduates of Stanford and Harvard and MIT to come and matriculate – or sorry, come and immigrate to the UK. In Canada, 40,000 graduates. And, you know, you just gave us an example, Sudeep's example. He's one of 40,000 graduates of American universities that have come to – that have immigrated to Canada. Australia, they have a global talent visa. They go to job fairs at universities to recruit international students, foreign-born students to come to Australia.
They like come here and they go to campuses, they go to, you know, Carnegie Mellon or whatever and just say, hey, we know you're going to have trouble getting an H-1B. Come to Sydney.
They advertise for this. There are billboards in Silicon Valley advertising the express immigration system that you mentioned in Canada. We'll hear, I think, a little bit more about that later in the program. And yeah, these countries are aggressively recruiting graduates and kind of happily recruiting, almost with a smile on their faces. I witnessed it when I went to report this in the UK. They're laughing at how they are recruiting these highly skilled immigrants that we're training and to a degree subsidizing. So Sudeep went to a public university. Even though, as you point out, international students are recruited by universities in part because they pay the full amount, there's still a public subsidy. And so, and if they are teaching assistants or doctoral candidates, they're paid for those jobs, and then we let them leave.
Wow. Okay. Well, I want to go to London now, briefly, where Nicholas Rawlison joins us. He's a partner and head of business immigration for the London-based law firm Kingsley Napley. Nick, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks.
Are you one of those people who's laughing at the U.S. immigration system?
Yeah, I have to say I'm sort of bemused, really, at how dysfunctional it seems and how, despite that, people still want to come to the to the U.S.
Well, I guess there's some hope for us there, at least.
Yeah.
But, okay, so tell me, what is it that you do for business immigration at Kingsley Napley?
Yeah, so I run a team of about 40 people, and we act for large corporations bringing people to work in the UK. That's mainly skilled people working in, you know, a range of sectors, including financial services, tech, media, the usual suspects. And we assist businesses in getting people sponsored, so they have to get a sponsor license, and then once they have the sponsor license, managing that and making sure they're compliant. And then getting the visas for the people who want to come over, they want to sponsor to come and work in the UK.
Okay, is this under that high potential individual visa that John was talking about?
Yeah, we've got, you know, the main work stream in the UK for work, employment-based work visas is called the skilled worker visa. That's the vast majority of cases, and that's through sponsorship through a company that's registered as a sponsor, and they, you know, can just go onto an online system. They can get what's called a certificate of sponsorship, which is like a electronic work permit, and they can get that within a day. And then we can apply for a visa for the person, and they can usually be in the UK within a few weeks. And that's for most occupations that are skilled sort of beyond sort of school leaver age. So, you know, it goes from, you know, CEOs of companies all the way down to bar managers, you know, so it's a pretty broad system. So that's the main system that people hire foreign talent from. But then we have also these other global talent streams, including the high potential individual visa. which is very useful. And we also have another global talent stream, which looks to attract the best talent in tech. So we have a Tech Nation visa specifically geared towards tech talent, both, you know, technical people who are dealing with the products and people running sort of tech businesses and founders of tech businesses. And then we have a whole bunch of other super, you know, talented global talent visas for people who are actors. So if you've won an Oscar, you're straight in. You know, if you're a well respected academic who's published lots of work, then you're straight in. If you've it's a bit like the sort of O-1 visa you have in the US, but it's not quite as document heavy as the US system.
It's not quite as document heavy. Okay. I have to say, I'm not sure I heard you correctly, Nick, because maybe my mind is just so imbued with the thoughts of the U.S. immigration system. Did you say that under certain circumstances, like you could apply for a U.K. work visa and be matched to a sponsor within a day? I'm not quite sure I heard that correctly.
So what happens is the employer identifies who they want to bring in, and it could be somebody who's already working for them in one of their global offices, or it could be a completely new hire. And they say, okay, this is the person we want. They don't have to jump through any hoops in terms of showing that, you know, there's no UK person who could do that role. You know, there's no quotas on these things. You simply go into a system and you input, you know, the person's job description, their salary, you know, the job title, the hours they work, and you submit that on an online system, which you kind of manage yourself. It goes through to the Home Office. And a day later, the Home Office will say, okay, that's fine. That meets all the requirements for sponsorship. You know, the person's paid enough. They come back to you the next day. You receive an electronic, you know, effectively an electronic work permit. And with that, you can then apply for the person's visa. And in the UK, visas are very quick. We can get them in the US. We can get them in 24 hours if we want to pay a high fee.
But you have to still pay for it. Okay, Nick, hang on here for just a second. So, John, Nick said something really interesting there about how a UK employer does not have to prove that there is a British citizen, that there's no British citizen they can find to fill the particular job that they want the foreign person to fill. That does not exist with the H-1B system here?
I don't know if that's a requirement. I can tell you practically that the fact is, and to be honest, in response to this story, not surprisingly, we've heard from a lot of people saying, why aren't we hiring Americans? That we do not have people who are American-born who can do these jobs. They're, as we discussed earlier, they're not going to graduate programs in these fields. We're not very good at math, apparently, according to the recent tests in K-12. And so the fact is that we do not have Americans who can do many of these jobs.
Okay. Nick, I'm curious about something else, because it still sounds, though, that the person coming to the UK after, you know, getting their degree from Rice University in the United States still has to have a UK employer. Were you going to say no?
I was going to say no. So the high potential individual that John mentioned earlier is one of those ones where you don't need a sponsor. You can come in. And all those global talent visas I mentioned, you don't need a sponsor either. So we often, and the way we get involved in this high potential individual visa from the US is that at a certain time of the year when the lottery results are announced, you know, a load of people are disappointed. The employers can't hire them. They're on their OPTs or, you know, whatever stage they're at in their immigration journey, and they can't stay in the US on an H-1B because they can't get into the lottery. And at that stage, if those guys are, you know, if they're graduating from one of those 21 universities that John mentioned, they've got a free pass straight into the UK, and we can just get them straight onto a visa. They don't need sponsorship. They can come and they can be here. And they can be in the UK doing what they want to do. In many cases, the US company will have a London office. You know, it may not already be a sponsor, but if it's not a sponsor, it's very easy then for that individual to come and work for the US company, you know, for a certain period of time, and then consider going back to the US at some stage in the future when they meet the requirements to be transferred back under different work categories.
Okay.
different visas.
John, I'm going to let you jump in here for a second, but I just want to read the name of some of the universities that we're talking about, Nick, that the UK has identified in the United States. The University of Washington, the University of Texas at Austin, University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, University of Pennsylvania, University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, a bunch of University of Californias, Berkeley, Los Angeles, San Diego. Then, of course, we've got the big marquee name, Stanford, Princeton, Northwestern, New York University, MIT, Caltech, et cetera, Cornell, Columbia. Wow, John.
Why don't we want to keep those graduates? It's kind of mind-blowing.
The thing is that as Nick is describing, I'm not sure I know of a work-based visa in the United States where you do not have to have a sponsor. This is a long-standing presumption in the United States that we haven't been able to budge.
You do have to have a sponsor with an H-1B. And the problem with the OPT that you mentioned earlier is you have graduates of these institutions. Often there's a delay. It's hard to find out exactly how long the delay is, but the delay was exacerbated by COVID. You graduate or you've applied for an OPT visa, you don't have it yet. So you have no income. You have expenses like rent, and Sudeep gave you an example of that. You don't have insurance, health insurance, once you've graduated from college, unless you buy it yourself, which is expensive. And so the longer that goes on, the less incentive that we have for people to stay. And so they begin, Nick mentioned, and when I met with him in London, he said around now, graduation season is when he begins to hear from people who have graduated from American universities who presumably would have stayed in the United States and are now reaching out or being referred to him to come to the UK.
Okay. Now, Nick, I wanted to take a quick step back here because obviously Britain has had and even continues to have a very contentious domestic view about immigration, similar to the United States. I mean, Brexit was one of the things that was fueled by anti-immigration sentiment in the UK. And yet, at the same time, has there been any pushback against these incredibly light-speed, fast-tracked visas for highly trained and qualified workers from elsewhere?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about UK opinion on immigration is that it's very split. So on the one hand, people don't like people arriving in small boats at the border, same thing as the US, people arriving at the border. And there's a very negative view on that. But on the skilled migration side, you know, the UK public doesn't really mind. They're quite happy with having skilled people. And the recent surveys and polls on attitudes to immigration in the UK have shown that, you know, repeatedly. And the UK is one of the most open and liberal in terms of views on skilled immigration. It still, you know, is negative on refugees and people arriving in small boats. But, you know, so the political context means that the government has quite a lot of flexibility in what it does. And it doesn't necessarily want to crack down on kind of skilled worker routes. Now, what happened this year is that there was a large surge in what we call net migration, the difference between people arriving and people leaving the UK, which was 600,000, which is one of the highest figures ever in history. And that was mainly due to people coming from Ukraine because of the war, mm-hmm. and people coming from Hong Kong because we have a special visa, and a big upsurge in skilled work visas since COVID and since the bottlenecks of COVID have been open. So a lot of people are coming in. But all the government's done is not close down all those routes. It's just actually said, oh, I tell you what, we've got too many dependents of students, so let's restrict that. And they will be doing that next year. So that's the only restriction we're seeing at the moment. But I have to say that the UK has, at the moment, a very open and liberal skilled migration policy, which encourages, you know, which is very fast and it helps to get business the people that they need.
Well, Nick Rawlison is partner and head of business immigration for the London-based law firm Kingsley Napley. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
John Marcus, Nick said something that I think also, from my estimation, is similar here in the United States, that, in fact, granting visas to highly skilled workers is an area of immigration policy that publicly in the U.S. has less disagreement than other aspects of immigration.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And this was explained to me by an immigration expert at Oxford as basically coming down to this. If you live in a country and you're told that there'll be a special visa for people that are quantum physicists, you don't care because you're not a quantum physicist. There's more antipathy to immigration among people who think that there might be someone admitted who can do the same job that person's doing at a lower wage. So in fact, skilled immigration doesn't have a lot of pushback in the UK. I should also mention one important point. The Global Talent Visa, or the Tech Nation Visa that Nick referred to, about 4,600 people have been admitted to the UK through that visa. And as you just heard, in just the last year, there are 600,000 net migration, essentially immigrants to the UK. So as you can see, it's a very small number, mm-hmm. but it's a symbol and it's a signification that we're willing to take you. And as one of the immigration experts in the United States said to me, what signal are we sending?
Well, John Marcus with the Hechinger Report. Stand by for just a moment. When we come back, we're going to talk more about how other countries are taking advantage of the fact that highly skilled, highly educated folks, foreign-born folks who were educated here in the United States are having trouble staying. So more in a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Just a little heads up on something we're working on for tomorrow. It's going to be a really fascinating conversation because we will be talking with Ula Obermann. You haven't heard of him, but you know what he does because he is TikTok's global head of music. He's the guy in charge of TikTok's program of finding new talent on its platform and creating the next generation of music stars. So what question do you have for him on TikTok's role in the music industry or about how music creation works now? You can record your question in the On Point Vox Pop app, which you can download by searching for On Point Vox Pop if you don't already have it. Or you can call us and leave your question at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And given TikTok's role in pop culture and, again, new music creation, I hope you have a lot of questions for Ula Obermann. It'll be a fascinating conversation tomorrow. Today, we're joined by John Marcus. He's higher education editor for the Hechinger Report, and he's written a fascinating article headlined, "With New Talent Visas, Other Countries Lure Workers Trained at U.S. Universities." And John, I just wanted to share a quick story that we got from another On Point listener. This is Siddharth Krishnamurthy from Pasadena, California, and he called to tell us about his journey trying to stay in the U.S. long term.
I have been in America for 13 years. I have a PhD in aerospace engineering from Stanford University, and I'm no longer a student, but I'm still struggling with the immigration system and still waiting for my green card, which has made life pretty difficult because there's so much uncertainty. Yes, there are people here who are highly qualified and also work in the national interest, as I think I do, and are actually kept out of America and actively pushed out. And this hurts American interests, but also at the heart of it is a very human story where someone's life is actually severely disrupted. Because having lived here for 13 years, it's very difficult for me to relocate my entire life and find a whole new life in another place.
So there we have an aerospace engineering PhD who wants to stay.
From Stanford,
exactly. Okay, so again, I want to, your article just really opened our eyes in terms of the advantage that other countries are taking with this, these hurdles that American educated folks are having difficulty clearing here. So, John, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, yes, we have seen mass layoffs at Amazon, Meta, Twitter, some of the Silicon Valley giants. But those mass layoffs have really nothing. They're not going to change the trajectory of the demand for tech workers because actually, you said this earlier, at least half of all new tech jobs are in companies outside of the tech field because technology is just so important for every company now. In fact, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the demand for computer and IT jobs will continue to grow by an estimated 15% by 2031. And I just love numbers, John, so we're going to do more here. According to the global consulting firm Manpower Group, 80% of employers in IT worldwide say they're struggling to fill jobs. And again, in the U.S., employers say they cannot find enough Americans with the right qualifications and experience. So that's an important factor to emphasize. So they're looking to hire foreign-born workers who were educated in the U.S., but the immigration system, excuse me, is a major hurdle. That's where Mark Pavlopoulos comes in. He's the CEO and founder of Syndesis, a company that keeps U.S.-trained and educated international workers at American tech companies by moving them to Canada.
So my conversation with the company is, what happens when they go back to home country, which 70% of the time it's going to be India? And the U.S. company response is almost always the same. It's, unfortunately, we will have to terminate this worker. With time zone issues, it's too far away. We will lose this worker. We will lose their expertise. We will lose an important member of the team. And then that's always what the U.S. company is facing. Then you go to the worker and it's like, their American dream is gone. All the hard work is out the window. They lose the job. They lose the ability to stay in the U.S. They lose everything they've built. So you're talking to two parties who are facing a complete loss.
Mark is an American. His company, Syndesis, is based in Canada. He focuses on small to mid-sized companies that don't have international offices already. So Syndesis sponsors these workers and becomes their de facto Canadian employer so that the employees can move to Canada and work remotely for their U.S. companies.
Still your same job, your same title, your same paycheck, your same U.S. boss. We're just handling your Canadian employment. From then on, we'll be your legal employer.
But why Canada? Well, just like we heard with the UK before, the biggest reason, speed.
I walked them through Canadian immigration. I said, let's picture the spreadsheet A and B. First, we'll talk about you weren't able to get the work visa. In this case, you will get the work visa. It's 99% of the time awarded. Of course, criminal record and some health issues may keep you out. But if you qualify, you get it based on your merit. So right away, there's a shock. So here's how Canada works. Here's your time frame to get permanent residence. Compare that to the time frame to get green card in the U.S. And the person's like, well, I can't even get the H-1B, so obviously green card's not an issue. And then I said, and here's your timeline to citizenship. It's about four and a half years from when you land. I'm like, there's your progression.
Mark is referring to Canada's Global Talent Stream Immigration Program. No lottery, merit-based, and most people who apply can get the three-year visa in a matter of weeks. And if you're married, your spouse can come and work in Canada, too. The worker can then apply for permanent residency, which Mark says could be granted in 6 months.
When you have your permanent residence, you have the right to work for Canadian companies or remotely for American companies like you're doing now. It's wide open. Everything's, your possibilities are there.
So Mark says it's a win-win for workers and employers, but
the loser in this scenario is the U.S. economy, because this person now is a taxpayer in Canada. The IP is still coming back to the U.S. company. So you might say like, well, the U.S. companies still continue to grow. Your clients are having global access to global talent. They're still, the company maintains their trajectory. But this person now is out of our tax base. If they, when they go to start a company, they won't be in the U.S. They're going to be in Canada.
Mark also told us that once in Canada, many workers move from job to job and eventually work for Canadian companies. Now, from 2017 to 2021, nearly 40,000 foreign-born graduates of U.S. universities were recruited to Canada. And Mark thinks that number will continue to grow unless the U.S. does something about it.
I don't see anything happening. I don't see no active debate on this. It's a toxic issue when it comes to U.S. politics. So if at some point you look at it and say, 30-plus years of H-1B program and no reforms, if you don't think it's going to change, then the mindset of the U.S. companies has to change.
That's Mark Pavlopoulos, CEO and founder of Syndesis. Okay, John Marcus, tell me, you know, from your reporting, really what you conclude the U.S. loses with its current system?
Well, I want to pick up on something that Mark just said, that he doesn't see this getting any better, the number of people that are being recruited to Canada and to other countries. I actually see a different problem. And the problem is that that international students, foreign-born students, will stop coming to U.S. universities. And that's already – there are signs that that's already happening. The immigration numbers are flat or down. They've rebounded a little bit from COVID. But even if you take the pandemic out of the picture, we've seen – we used to see steady growth. And then things started to plateau even before the pandemic. There are survey data that suggests that international students are less convinced, just frankly, as American students are these days too, about the value of getting a degree in the United States, because they are seeing and hearing more about the fact that it will be harder for them to stay.
Yeah, so but there's differences in the reasons why, right?
There are huge differences in the reasons why. One reason is it's very expensive. I think that reason is the same across the board, domestic and international. But international students came to the United States in part, not all of them, but in part aspiring to stay. And because they know now that that's very difficult and that other countries are more welcoming to them, and also because other countries are competing not only in the immigration visa arena, but in recruiting international students, the United States is no longer the automatic go-to. Another problem for us is that our number one sending nation has historically been China. And because of, you know, other issues between the United States and China, those numbers are also going down. That's a $45 billion a year hit. That is the economic impact of international students on American universities and their communities.
Because they're paying to go to the universities and they are in those communities as well.
Yes. Well, we're sitting in one of the communities where there are a lot of international students, and you only have to look out the window of this building to see a lot of international students who bring wealth to the community, who drive nice cars, who pay the full tuition. And that is a problem for universities, which already have a lot of other problems with their enrollment, whether international students will still feel that it's worth their time to come here.
Now, John, you had to make it specific to what we see around us in the greater Boston area, because the flip side to that is every time I see a foreign student, and I'm just going to speak my truth here, who's driving a Maserati on Commonwealth Avenue right outside the On Point Studios, I think to myself, well, okay, if that person didn't come, I understand it would be a financial hit to the university, but isn't there a counter argument to, well, wouldn't that then be a spot for an aspiring American student?
Assuming that there were aspiring American students in enough of a supply that universities were seeing, you know, more applicants. And in fact, enrollment at universities, domestic and international, has been declining now for more than a decade.
Okay, so you're saying that there's not an adequate K through 12 pipeline in the U.S. for these undergraduate and graduate spots?
Well, two things are happening. Fewer high school graduates are going directly to college after finishing high school in the following fall. That number is down nationally by 7 percentage points, from a peak of 70% to about 63% now. In some states like Tennessee and Indiana, it's down 12 percentage points. That's the question of value. The second issue is demographics. Mm-hmm. We begin to run out of 18-year-olds in 2026, 18 years after the 2008 recession, which is when people stopped having as many children. So those two things are conspiring to really hurt American enrollment. So not to digress too much from our conversation about immigration, but international students are not necessarily taking up spaces that might go to Americans, nor are all international students, we should both point out, driving Maseratis around Commonwealth Avenue.
That is also true.
But
yes.
For all of those that we see, we also see a lot of international students whose parents work hard to be able to afford their tuition, or whose governments subsidize them to come and you know, study in the United States.
Yeah. Thank you for saving me from many angry emails. Maybe it's just Boston University and Commonwealth Avenue, which is in Boston, folks. But anyway, John, so that's the potential economic hit to universities and their communities. But what about the U.S. economy as a whole, if we're not keeping these folks, again, just to reiterate the whole point of your story, that have been educated at the same top universities in the United States, and we are not keeping them here to then be workers and potentially, you know, entrepreneurs or business owners, of future American business owners?
We are pushing AI half of the people in graduate programs that lead to AI are international students. We're pushing semiconductor development through the CHIPS Act. We aren't producing enough people to do the brain power that that requires. We are engaged in an international competition in a knowledge economy. We're not keeping up.
Okay. So I need you to take me back to Congress, though, because as we started the conversation, you had you laid out that the H-1B program, that the cap on it, hasn't changed in 30 years. Immigration has obviously been the hot button issue in the United States. But even there, you know, if memory serves, Donald Trump himself, you know, had said maybe we should have more of a merit-based system. So if there is some kind of political overlap regarding these, again, these high-skilled workers that we want to keep in the United States, why haven't we seen any progress?
Donald Trump twice proposed a merit-based immigration system. There have been and are now currently bills in Congress to allow for skilled immigration or to expand skilled immigration or make it or streamline it. They've never gone anywhere. I'm not a political reporter, but my sense as an American is that this is just an issue no one is prepared to step up to fix.
I don't understand why.
If we either one of us knew the answer to that question, you know, I think we'd be smarter than a lot of other people that are trying to figure it out as well.
Ugh. Okay, but just to be clear, because we were talking about this earlier before the show, John, the intent of the Trump administration, or when Donald Trump, you know, was touting the glories of a merit-based system, may not have necessarily been to maximize the number of, you know, highly skilled workers in the United States.
It might have been to draw a contrast between, or let me say that smarter people than me have suggested, it was to say we shouldn't allow people who, there's a lot of controversy over the word skills. Who are we to say what a skill is? But to take people with skills in, for example, tech or healthcare and differentiate them from other immigrants that people may not want to see accepted.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point, because every time I've read about merit-based immigration systems, the first bit of pushback that comes is you can't predict what skills you'll need in the future.
It's not particularly equitable to say that someone that could afford to go to Stanford should be allowed to immigrate into any country. I mean, that's a much bigger question that has also been raised by activists, including in the UK and other countries where they are welcoming immigrants with what we've been referring to as skills.
Yeah. Well, because the point being also that there's something about fundamental about how the American immigration system has believed what it's believed to have stood for more than a century, that we take this is not necessarily the case anymore, but this is the land of immigrants, and we'll take anyone who has the drive to want to succeed here. And so by advancing any kind of program that might, like you say, produce a little bit of an inequity there, that might sort of strike at the heart of the American immigration story.
It's possible, I think, to have an immigration system that can do both, to like Canada does, to be honest, that has it has a very robust immigration system for refugees at one end, and at the other end, it makes it very easy for the kind of people that they need to drive the industries that are the most competitive globally.
Yeah. And meanwhile, while that's not happening here in the U.S., we have people who have gone to the best universities this country has, some of the best in the world, and they're waiting years, and they're just giving up and going elsewhere.
If they get in at all.
If they get in at all here in the United States. Well, John Marcus, editor at the Hechinger Report, we've got a link to your story at onpointradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.